This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. For years now, Democrats and Republicans in Washington have been playing a game of chicken. Time and again, we've been taken to the brink of one disaster or another because neither side wants to back away from its principles. Even when there isn't a crisis, even when it's just business as usual, the divide between the two sides is so wide and so deep that compromise seems out of the question. And without compromise, Congress can't function. This has led to frustration among citizens, but it's also led to frustration on the part of those we elect to Congress. Several congresspeople and senators have chosen not to run for re-election in recent years, bemoaning the lack of bipartisanship and the gridlock that has made it impossible for elected officials to do the jobs they feel they were elected to do. A group of freshman congressmen have formed a coalition to try and work together for the good of the country. These freshman Republican and Democratic representatives decided to find solutions through collaboration and formed the United Solutions Caucus to make that happen. That caucus was founded by a Florida Democrat and a North Carolina Republican, and they join us for the hour. Representative Robert Pittenger is from our state's 9th District. That's Sue Myrick's old seat, and he joins us from our Spirit Square studio. Welcome to the program for the first time. Nice to have you here.
Good morning, Mike. Always good to see you.
Good to see you as well. Sue Myrick was here a lot. I hope you'll come back.
Yes, sir. It's great to be with you.
Mm-hmm. And Patrick Murphy is from Florida's 18th District, which includes an area of eastern Florida from Palm Beach Gardens through Martin County and St. Lucie County. And Congressman Murphy joins us by phone, where he tells us it is sunny and 65. Thank you, Congressman. Appreciate it.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for being with us. Congressman Pittenger, you are not known for being soft on Democrats or liberals. During your time in the state legislature, it is said that you were not known to want to compromise very much. At what point did you decide that doing this in Congress, helping to form this caucus for bipartisan cooperation, it was a good idea and a necessary one?
Well, actually, Mike, while I was in the legislature, several initiatives that I did have on restructure, I did work with Speaker Black's office on Medicaid fraud. I took Tony Rand in to see Jim Goodnight, the CEO of SAS, because I knew that we needed the Democrat leadership to run the ball down the field, and I really didn't care who scored the goal.
And in fact, to be fair to you, Speaker Black told you on more than one occasion that this whatever measure you were proposing would do better if it didn't have your name on it.
That's
and
right.
You took your name off of it so it could go through the legislature.
Yes, sir. Exactly. And that was the prudent thing to do. But today, I really embrace the opportunity to work with my colleagues in the Congress, Congressman Murphy and his Democrat colleagues. We've built some friendships there that I think will be long-lasting.
Now, Congressman Murphy, you're a Democrat. You voted against the Ryan budget, the latest Ryan budget. You've also said that the country has some big problems that need to be solved, including our budgetary problems. So at what point did you decide that dialogue might lead to progress?
Well, the truth is I used to be a Republican, actually, and I think Robert knows that. To me, you know, I got into politics because I was tired of complaining and pointing a finger, and it was never about, to me personally, the partisanship. You know, I think that's what's killing our country, and I'd say this freshman class, there's 84 new members, by and large were elected on a message of bipartisanship, of working together. And the very first few weeks before we actually took office, before we took the oath, we had several orientations. We would have speakers, economists, and panelists, prime ministers from all over the world came to present to the freshman class. And we'd talk about all sorts of issues. I mean, things from immigration to health care, the debt, jobs. And after each of these, you know, orientations, these briefings, the Republicans and Democrats would, you know, we'd go to lunch or dinner, you know, whatever it would be, and have a conversation. And lo and behold, we were agreeing on, say, 80% of what the solution should be. So we thought we could really make some good headway there. And Mr. Pittenger and I started talking about what we can do to really formalize this this group of individuals willing to look at the solutions and get over the partisanship. And started off with that letter that you alluded to earlier.
Many in the previous Congress were elected, at least the previous House, were elected because they are of their affiliation with the Tea Party, which had a very serious agenda and one that they were committed to. And that led to a lot of gridlock because they weren't going to budge off the principles that they felt got them elected and the ones that they ran on and the ones that they felt deep in their hearts needed to be solved. And no Democrat, no mealy-mouthed Republican was going to get in their way. Is this new freshman class that Congressman Murphy just described as being bipartisan a response to that?
Well, I think it's more response to the issues at hand. When we heard people like Peter Orszag, who was the budget writer for Mr. Obama for 4 years, make the declaration a number of times during his presentation that we have to address the debt. That's the single biggest issue in our country. Mm-hmm. And unless we do address the debt, then we're going to face a collapse financially like Greece and other countries. And then he said, you know, beyond the debt or to address the debt, we've got to take a look at entitlements and find real cost savings there. And so that really began a conversation that built these relationships and allowed us to say, hey, we're all recognized the seriousness of these problems.
Congressman Murphy mentioned these orientation centers, sessions that freshman congressmen are invited to attend before they matriculate into the Congress, I suppose, if that's the right word to use. And you talked about this, too, in some material that I got before our conversation, that you'd go and there weren't many Republicans at these orientation sessions.
Sure.
So you went out with Democrats and got to know them.
Well, that's partly true. We had two in Washington, and they were great, and most everybody was there. We did have one at Harvard, and there were a fewer number of Republicans up there. Let's just say that. I was a sole voice of some issues. But that really, it just was a tremendous time mm-hmm. to get to know these people. And we're all concerned about the state of our country and where we are.
I know that neither one of you were there in Congress in the 1960s or 50s or 40s or 70s, even when Democrats and Republicans used to fight on the floor and then go out for a drink and dinner after the session was over.
That's true. They're founding fathers.
Yeah. But is this a return to that? Do you see this as a return to that? Congressman Murphy.
I'll jump in. Sure. I think it's the beginning steps of it, but it's certainly there are all sorts of other pressures, I think, pulling on members of Congress nowadays. I don't want to just speak for Robert and I, but, you know, there are a lot of demands for us to get back to our district. You know, 20, 30 years ago and beyond, members of Congress would go to D.C. and stay longer. They would bring their families there. Their kids would go to school. They would get to know each other, their wives and, you know, spouses and children. It made it much tougher mm-hmm. To call each other names and to create this environment of divisiveness. Nowadays, right when we're done with votes, people rush to the airport and get home. That could be, you know, argued in different ways, but that's just the reality of it.
Is that because members of Congress want to go home and hobnob with the constituents to find out what they're thinking, talking about, feeling, or is it simply because they want to go home? They want to get out of Washington?
I would say there's a few reasons. One is there's a more demands, I think, on members of Congress to be present in your district, to be out at the town hall, to be at the local fair, the charity event, you name it, to be out there seen in your district. And number two, I think fundraising pulls people home more than it used to and quicker than it used to, which is just a shame. I'm disgusted by the fundraising and money in politics, but that's probably a different subject.
Yeah. So because you can go home more frequently than you could when the train existed or you had to get on a horse and go, people do, and therefore that limits the amount of socialization time. Is that what you're saying?
I believe it does. I mean, Robert and I and others have certainly done what we can to, while we're in town, while we're in D.C., to go out of our way to make time to get together, and whether that's breakfast, lunch, or dinner, we're certainly doing what we can to start to build those relationships. And Robert had a great idea a couple weeks ago that we wanted to do a sort of a retreat, a freshman class retreat, get together, go somewhere fun, and you know, sort of break down those false barriers and get to know each other.
And did you do it?
Well, we're planning it. I mean, okay. Fishing or whatever it is.
Okay.
We just want to continue what we started.
I would suggest you do it in Florida.
Yeah.
It's warmer there this morning.
That's what he said, too.
I have brought that up to Patrick a time or two.
At least if it happens in the next couple of weeks. Congressman Murphy mentioned that 80% of the Democrats and Republicans in Congress seem to agree on, or at least people in the Congress seem to agree on 80% of the issues. Would you agree with that figure, Congressman Pittenger? And if that is true, why is there so much rancor about everything.
Sure. I mean, there is definitely polarization. I would say that there's definitely agreement that the issues that we've got to address. We have national security issues. We have immigration issues. We have issues related, of course, to the economy. And I think, in by and large, there is consensus and there is common ground on these concerns and how we must need to address
them. But if you want to remain in the favor of the party and the favor of the base of the party, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, can you admit that out loud, really, that I agree with the other side? Or we have common ground with the other side? Isn't that sacrilege?
Well, I think that's what we're about. Mike, I think that's what we're about. I think that's what United Solutions is about. Where can we find common ground?
Mm-hmm.
And we're setting up several task forces that Patrick presented some at our last meeting that I thought were excellent, beyond what we're trying to do with the debt and our fiscal concerns. So, you know, we're dealing with Medicaid and Medicare. We're dealing with energy issues and immigration issues, and we have set up task forces to do that.
Let me ask you that same question, Congressman Murphy, because as you said, you used to be a Republican, and something about the Republican Party at some point in your life turned you off and you became a Democrat, and now you're trying to reach across the aisle and work with those people, but you're a turncoat in their eyes, aren't you?
I've been called all sorts of things, so I'm not sure what that doesn't bother me, though. I mean, I don't know what they call me or consider me. I think the bottom line is we're all focused, as Robert just said, on the same issues and getting to the same point. You know, of course, there are some disagreements on some of those issues, but that's what we're trying to work through, and that's the whole point of getting to know each other and putting everything on the table and seeing where it falls and how we can find an agreement.
What made you cross the line to the other side of the aisle?
You know, I was raised in a household that was always about the individual, always about the candidate, never the party. And when I registered to vote when I was 18 or, you know, whatever, my dad's my mentor, my best friend, and he's a Republican, so I registered as a Republican. And as I began following the politics and the Iraq War, quite frankly, I was became disenfranchised with the Republican Party because I thought we were being lied to, and you know, continued to vote for the person. And when the Tea Party, you know, started getting momentum, it was a movement of fiscal responsibility, which I'm completely in favor of. I'm a CPA by training and have a small business and support fiscal responsibility, but it went off on more of a social agenda and divisiveness, and I didn't support that part of it. Decided I was going to sit back and complain, and I had to throw my hat in the ring and change parties and do something about it.
So when you hear your colleague here talk about the Tea Party and the Republican Party and why he shifted gears here, does that get your back up? I mean, how do you do business with a guy who used to be on your side and traded sides, and now you're together forming this United Solutions caucus? How do you get beyond that?
It's a matter of respect for the individual and allowing that person to be who they are. That doesn't change my convictions or what I believe, but you find out where people's thinking are, and you reason. You build relationships, and out of those relationships, then you can have reasonable conversations. I think so much of the conflict and what we've seen in terms of people not being able to get along is because they've never sought out to try to know each other.
This sounds so grown up.
Well,
that's not what Congress is about anymore, is it?
Well, hopefully that clear minds will prevail. But well, we frankly just enjoy each other's relationships.
We're going to come back and talk about exactly what United Solutions Caucus is, how many people are in it, what you're trying to accomplish with this, some of the initiatives that you see as the most important issues to tackle. And we'll do that when we come back from the break. Congressman Robert Pittenger from North Carolina, Congressman Patrick Murphy from Florida, our guests. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Northeastern University Charlotte, hosting a graduate roundtable information session April 10th for degrees in business administration, health informatics, and leadership. Details at northeastern.edu/Charlotte. And U.S. National Whitewater Center's Tuck Fest, April 19th through 21st, celebrating the outdoor lifestyle with races, competitions, demos, live music, and more. Details at usnwc.org. Western medicine seems to have a pill for everything, but Eastern medicine, not so much. And what started as an Eastern medical philosophy has now crossed the sea and become the whole health movement, which encourages individuals to take more control of their own health through dietary and exercise changes, and to take advantage of alternative or integrative therapies. We'll look into many of those tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the crisis in Cyprus sheds a light on how investors shelter their wealth, understanding international tax havens and their effect on economies around the world.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to the two co-founders of the United Solutions Caucus. It's a new caucus in the Congress to try to find bipartisan solutions to the nation's most serious problems. It was started by our two guests, Representative Robert Pittenger from North Carolina's 9th Congressional District here in the Charlotte area, and Patrick Murphy, Florida's 18th District Congressman, a Democrat. Mr. Pittenger, of course, is a Republican, and Mr. Murphy represents a good part of eastern Florida. Exactly. There's a lot of different caucuses in Congress. Exactly how do caucuses function, Mr. Pittenger?
Well, we function in a way of just mutual respect. I mean, we come from two different parties, but as Patrick and I talked about the opportunity to build these relationships and then focus on important issues, that we saw the bigger picture of uniting a number of our colleagues from both parties to join with us, and that's what created initially the first letter that we wrote, that 35 of us wrote to the president, to the congressional leadership, and imploring them to address the debt and to find ways to in savings that we could achieve that objective.
How did you recruit members for this caucus, Mr. Murphy?
Well, it started in those orientations we talked about a little while ago, where we would a lot of the orientation focused on our country's fiscal house, and that is, of course, a major priority, if not the top priority, for most people elected to Congress recently. And we started breaking it down into different issues and approaches in these orientations, and started to find a lot of common ground with each other, Republicans and Democrats, that is. And when Congressman Pittenger and I started drafting this letter, we each kind of went out to our respective caucus and people we'd been meeting in these orientations and asking if they were interested in something like this and getting their input. And slowly but surely adding people on to the interest level. Once we had a letter somewhat, finalized, then we went out for signatures. And I basically, at one of the orientations, we had a group meeting. I had all the Democrats there and presented the letter to them and asked who would be interested. Most of them had already known about it. And, either got their support or said that they were going to hold back for now, but they are interested in the idea of bipartisanship working together on future sort of topics.
There are 30 or 35 people. I've gotten two different numbers here. How many people are in the caucus?
The final letter had 36, the final one.
Okay. More Republicans than Democrats still?
I believe so.
What's wrong with the Democrats? Why don't they want to join in on this?
I think Robert might just be more convincing than me, maybe. Better still, I guess. I don't know.
He's picking up steam. I'm proud of him. He's had a good number of people coming to our recent meetings.
Now, there are 535 congresspeople, is that right?
435 in the House and 100 in the Senate.
435, excuse me. So that means more people. Did you ask everybody to join?
Freshmen.
Oh, just the freshmen. How many freshmen are there?
84.
So did you ask all 84 freshmen to join?
Yes, probably.
Sure.
So more people turned you down than took you up on your offer, is that right?
Well, let's say this. This is the first foray. This is when you're into forming something new, people need to see what you're exactly about. And it was easier for some people to understand it early on. And as we move along, I've had more and more. I had an email from somebody last night late saying, I'm really interested in this. I really want to be a part of it. I want to start coming to the meetings. So I think it's a growing thing that as we look at other issues, that we'll be able to embrace a broader number of members.
Now, this started only in February, so we're not even a month into this caucus. But you issued a statement of principles calling for bipartisan solutions to Social Security, Medicare reform, tax reform, and streamlining government. How did you come up with those principles, those things to work on?
Well, I think that's the elephant in the room. I think there are major issues that we have to address. Where can we find some common ground in achieving some thoughtful, realistic goals to bring some fiscal accountability and to those safety nets, and allowing them and preserving them for the future? So we all share the concern that those safety nets need to be there, and how can we make sure that that's achieved?
If you listen to the pundits, if you turn on Fox News or you turn on MSNBC, you will hear people say things like one side wants to gut Social Security and Medicare. They want to cut taxes for the rich. They want to destroy the regulatory foundation of the country. The other side says they want to shore up entitlements for the poor and the middle class, raise taxes to pay for them, regulate businesses out of business. It's hard to find middle ground if you listen to the pundits. And since you've been on both sides of the aisle, Congressman Murphy, how do you find the middle ground? Where is it on these issues?
You know, I think we've got to rise above sort of that mainstream media. The media doesn't report the plane that lands on time. You know, that old saying, if we were just getting along, shaking hands, making deals every day, there wouldn't be a whole lot to talk about, probably. So they want the drama. They want to make this as explosive as possible. We're trying to rise above that and not buy into what we hear about each other on the media and what they're saying about our respective parties. And you know, when we were doing this letter, Congressman Pittenger and I went to our leadership and our parties and spoke to them about it. And I don't want to speak on his behalf, but I know what happened when I presented this letter to my leadership. They were happy about it. They were proud. They said, you know, this is exactly what we need. This is the way things used to get done in Congress. Right now we're at a standstill. We need you all to lead from the bottom up. And we're proud of you all for doing this. You know, maybe they'd tweak a thing here or there in the letter, but by and large they were very happy with the progress that we're making as freshmen.
What reaction did you get from the Republican leadership?
Exactly the same. Speaker Boehner, Majority Leader Cantor, all of them, they thought this was a tremendous wave, and they hoped that the momentum continued.
Now, I referenced Fox News and MSNBC because they are the polar opposites on cable television. One is the liberal network, one is the conservative network. At least that's what most people believe, and I think both of them will admit, at least NBC, certainly MSNBC will certainly admit that they're the liberal point of view. But do you consider them the mainstream media because they're cable channels? Or is the mainstream media the three major television networks plus the New York Times, the Washington Post, etc.? And are they as inflammatory, in your view, in this political conversation as Fox and MSNBC?
Well, let me just say they're in the business to sell time. They have to create a story. And without a story, there's no interest. Where there's no interest, there's no ratings. Where there's no ratings, they don't sell they don't sell ads. And so, that's therein lies your perception of what's taking place. And we're just trying to – we put that aside. That's not going to dictate what we do and how we measure our objectives and our success.
Well, you said that in your meetings behind the scenes with other congressmen from the other party, et cetera, that you found out that not only did you agree on a lot of the issues, you genuinely liked each other. And that's not sexy enough for the mainstream media to report on because they like to highlight other things. Is that a dangerous admission in today's world to say, I like this guy? He's not – because, people got in trouble for embracing – some congressperson got in trouble for embracing President Obama. The New Jersey Governor Christie got in trouble just before the election for complimenting the president on his handling of Hurricane Sandy. If you say anything nice about the other side, I don't care whether you're a Democrat or a Republican – you are walking a thin wire.
I'll tell you a funny story. So I'm over in the chamber getting ready to vote, and Joe Kennedy approaches me, Joe Kennedy III. He's a new freshman member.
Who you like, by the way, I'm told.
Well, he approaches, sure, we have a relationship. We've gotten to know each other in a half dozen of these conferences. And he says, Robert, will you sit next to me during the State of the Union? I said, sure, Joe, be glad to. So I showed up that night, a little late. I didn't realize it. The chamber was filled up by 8:15 for a 9 o'clock speech. And but there are a few seats over on our far side. You know, the Democrats on one side, Republicans on the other. But on the far side of the chamber, I found some seats. And Joe saw me, said, "You know, I think I've got some seats over more toward the middle. And why don't we sit over there?" I said, "Joe, you Kennedys are so politically insecure." But anyway, I sat with Joe during the speech. That may surprise somebody. I mean, I'm as conservative probably as most people that you can find. Mm-hmm. I didn't stand when Joe stood, and maybe he didn't stand when I stood. But we have a compatible relationship. And where we can find common ground, we're going to find that. But that doesn't keep me from having a relationship. I don't have to abandon my principles or my philosophies.
Just from an outsider's point of view, the Republicans are experts at galvanizing the troops, at getting them to march in lockstep and keeping to the message, which is why they've been so successful, I think, because the Democrats are – it's like herding cats. And since you've been on both sides of the aisle here, Congressman Murphy, is it more difficult for a Republican to think like Representative Pittenger and act like Representative Pittenger? Is there more pressure not to act that way on a Republican than a Democrat?
He could answer that. I definitely don't want to, you know, speak for him. You know, I think parties change. I think as the pendulum kind of swings in our country, both parties have, you know, sort of shown to be united and to be divided. I think right now you could probably argue that the Republican Party isn't necessarily in lockstep, that there is a little bit of a division there in the party. And I'm not, you know, saying Democrats haven't been like that and that we haven't been divided in 10 ways, not just mm-hmm. two. I don't want to speak for Robert on that. I think back to kind of your earlier point, though. You know, the public wants results. I think generally there are, of course, the fringe on either side that don't want you to talk to your opposite party. But by and large, the people I speak with in my district just want results. Well, they're so frustrated by the divisiveness. They don't care if you're Republican or Democrat. So they want us to get to the middle. And I think it's not just up to members of Congress or any level of politics to start compromising, but it's up to the voters to recognize folks willing to do that and to support those people and not only vote for their party, but vote for the people they think are going to deliver results because they're willing to compromise.
Do you think that's true? I mean, the problem is it's absolutely true that I think that the citizens, people who vote you into office, want results. But what results do they want? Do they want the results that they perceived you to support, or do they just want something to happen, a decision to be made, a direction to be chosen? What do they want? Because you're under, I would think, a lot of pressure from constituents to vote one way or the other on almost every issue.
Yeah, and I would say it would go issue by issue, of course, and group by group to tell you that, but by and large, things like our economy, which is jobs, I mean, that's a pretty big one. Part of our caucus, I mean, the main focus of it is getting our economy back on track. And the best way that we feel we can do that is by sort of getting to this grand bargain, by putting everything on the table, ensuring that our debt is in line. And if we can put our country on a pathway to bringing down our long-term debt, which includes, you know, closing loopholes, which includes looking at some Social Security and Medicare programs, talking about everything, provide that security to entrepreneurs, to business owners, that sort of stability. We feel the private sector would unleash the trillions of dollars that they're sitting on right now. So they just want some sort of action and stability, and then they'll do the rest.
Let me get your point of view on that, because, for instance, if you're a Tea Party Republican, and you're not, but if you are, you were elected, you presume, because of your principles. And your principles have made you intransigent. And there are Democrats on the other side who will not budge on certain entitlement programs because that's what they feel their base wants them to protect. Do you vote your conscience or do you vote for what your constituents want?
Well, you have to vote what is going to be an actual solution. If you vote just what your constituents want, then you're just voting to be reelected. If you're not here for principle,
But if you're spending a lot of time raising money to get elected, isn't that what your focus is on a lot? I'm not accusing you or blaming you. That's just the system.
I understand. It's the system. I would beg the question, the founding fathers, why they didn't make four-year terms. That would be been a good thing. Mm-hmm. I think right now let's—
– You're in Congress. Change it.
Yeah. Well, the states would be involved in that.
Yeah, I know.
Let's step back.
Okay.
Let's say, what can we do? You know, you eat an elephant one bite at a time. We need to. What can we do as a freshman caucus? Where can we find those cost savings? You know, the American people want a government that's fiscally accountable. They don't like hearing about waste. We have, a Medicaid program that we need to find a greater amount of accountability in it. I worked significantly on that in the state level, mm-hmm. where we could achieve probably $500 million. Annually in savings. Frankly, I talked yesterday to the president of SAS, Dr. Mm-hmm. Jim Goodnight.
That's a software company.
Yes, mm-hmm. major software company internationally, and they have software that will go through, you know, a patient's record and look for aberrations of where it's been exploited, where there's Medicaid fraud. He also has software that will really help define eligibility. Right now, people are being signed into to Medicaid without any consideration. There is no basis. They're just signed up for it. And you can determine who's really eligible and who's not. Mm-hmm. We're really not doing that. We signed up just since January 1, I think, over 250,000 people without any eligibility requirements. So I think all of us would look at thoughtful, prudent, practical ways in terms of addressing fraud and addressing eligibility.
You have, as you said, been a proponent of getting a handle on Medicaid fraud for a long time.
Sure.
You started this in the legislature, and now you're carrying that into Congress. Why is this so important to you? Why is this kind of a pet issue?
No, it's one among many. I mean, I was involved as well with restructure of the state government, mm-hmm. and this was just part of that overall plan. What I did in the state government was working with a national accounting firm, actually the same firm that my good friend Patrick was a member of, and we looked at opportunities for cost savings, looked at other states, looked at Texas and Florida, Massachusetts. Happened to be the Massachusetts, with a Democrat legislature and a Republican governor, saved $3 billion.
60 Minutes has done several stories on Medicaid fraud, which are just they make your blood boil when mm-hmm. you find out who's cheating and by how much they're cheating the government and how they seem to get away with it or have gotten away with it with impunity. And then you hear about the $150 hammers and the, mm-hmm. The $2,000 toilet seats that the military has been known to buy from time to time. And you just wonder, who's minding the store up there and why? Because after a while, this adds up to real money.
Well,
why hasn't there been more of a push to get a handle on this before?
Well, I agree. You inspect what you expect. And that's part of what I think we can help address and give some focus to. We need to get it on the radar screen. We need to get it on the out there in the public so the public understands it and the Congress is really pushing it. So these are things I believe that we can find common ground and realistic solutions.
Social Security is on your list of things that you want to help shore up, I believe is the term that you use. But a lot of Democrats are suspicious of Republicans wanting to gut it because they didn't like it in the first place when FDR put it into practice. And some Democrats will just simply not budge on some things about Social Security because that's their base. Their base wants that. What can be done, what must be done to fix Social Security so that it sticks around for people when they need it?
I'll go ahead and take a stab at that. You know, like Robert mentioned earlier, some of the five task forces.
Congressman, it's my fault. I asked a question that there's not enough time to answer in the time allotted. So let me come back and let you take a crack at that in just a second, okay?
Okay.
My fault. Excuse me. Every once in a while that happens. We're taking a break with Congressman Patrick Murphy and Congressman Robert Pittenger. Charlotte Talks on WAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Crown Archetype, publisher of Sum It Up by Pat Summitt, sharing her struggles and triumphs in coaching basketball and facing early onset Alzheimer's disease, available wherever books are sold. And Charlotte Living Online, supporting For Your Home Philanthropy House, hosted by Vicki Payne, April 18th in Morrowcroft, supporting the Allegro Foundation, Carolina Breast Friends, and Taylor's Table. The Crisis in Cyprus sheds a light on how investors shelter their wealth, understanding international tax havens and their effect on economies around the world, the topic at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or every other way imaginable, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
The moth is coming to Charlotte.
Growing up in the South, there was a right way to do things and a wrong way to do things. And the right way was to do what your family and society thought you should do. And the wrong way was to do something different.
Join WFAE for an evening of live storytelling as The Moth comes to town Thursday evening, May 16th at 7:30. Tickets are available now at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Congressman Robert Pittenger from North Carolina's 9th Congressional District is with us in the studio. Congressman Patrick Murphy from Florida's 18th District is with us by phone. He's a Democrat. Congressman Pittenger is a Republican. They put together something called the United Solutions Caucus, a bipartisan effort to reach solutions on some of the key problems facing the country. It could be a first, ladies and gentlemen, at least a first in many, many years. And I asked the question just before the break about what can be done without destroying it to shore up and Social Security and Medicare, because that's one of your key issues, so that it'll be now and we'll use it in the future. And Congressman Murphy, you tried to start that answer and I had to stop you, so let's go ahead and pick it up where we left off.
Sure. I'll just start off by saying I don't think there's enough time if we had the whole day to solve Social Security and Medicare. These are big issues, but that's why they're being addressed. And what we did in this group is break up this United Solutions group, break it up into five task forces that we've asked everyone that's part of the task force to go and get a report, come up with their own sort of mini solutions that they can present to the whole group and see if we can come to an agreement at that point. So the first one is strengthen and preserve Medicare and Social Security. And there's certain Democrats, as you said earlier, that aren't going to want to hear a Democrat like myself talk about this. But the fact is, it's got to be on the table. And the president came to Congress about 2 weeks ago and spoke to all of us about it and said that we've got to make some changes and that our debt to GDP for the next 10 years is in a sustainable, at a sustainable level. But beyond that, once you get to about that 10-year mark, it sort of blows up. And we have to start making some changes to ensure that these programs can continue to survive for generations to come. So the task force looking at Social Security and Medicare are going to start analyzing everything, all the approaches that have been made, all the ideas. And that task force hasn't presented yet, so I don't want to give you their solutions. But basically, what they're doing is going to look at things like raising the cap and see what that ends up doing. If you were to raise it from $113,000 to, say, $150,000, how many years of life does that add? They're going to do the same thing with Medicare. They're going to look at all the options and have this sliding scale and see if Republicans and Democrats can sit there and say, you know, you do a little bit of this, we do a little bit of that, and lo and behold, we've added, 30 years of life to the program.
I mean, that's the way it's always been done. You give and take, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and we come up with a solution that we can all vote yes on, and we move on to the next problem. But in recent years, that has not been something that Congress has seemed to be able to do, because people will not give a little of anything. And that goes on both sides of the aisle. Why do you think you'll be successful in these conversations that you're having in this caucus? Do you think if this caucus comes up with a solution that Democrats and Republicans within the caucus can agree on, that that will extrapolate out to the Congress at large?
Well, we're sure going to try. I can't speak for the whole Congress, but I can speak for at least our little group and tell you that when we have these meetings, these United Solutions Caucus meetings, that there's a spirit of camaraderie and one that is more concerned with solutions and our country than getting reelected. And that's what it's going to take, is more members of Congress willing to put what's best for the country ahead of their reelection and to have that courage. So,
Mike, we're in my perspective, we're straightening pictures while the house is burning down. Hmm. I mean, the country has very serious issues with our debt. We have to preserve Social Security and Medicare. Medicare has a shorter time fuse. Even in the next decade, it'll be insolvent. So these are uppermost in our minds. And frankly, we just came out of a series of briefings, you know, with very capable people who kept pounding this in our ears. And so it's prominent to us that we have to join together and set aside other issues and concerns and really focus on the big matter at hand.
Except in recent years when the government has tried to tackle big issues, they either didn't do it, they just put it, they tabled it, they shoved it down the road, they kicked the can, or they put together a health care plan that a lot of people hate. It hasn't even gone into effect completely yet, but they hate it. And people are now saying that it may raise insurance premium prices on everybody in the country, and it still won't solve the problem that we set out to solve in the first place, and that is lowering the cost of medical care, which is bankrupting individuals and is ultimately going to bankrupt the country if we don't get a handle on this. And if you read Stephen Brill's article in Time magazine, the medical pharmaceutical industrial complex is far more powerful and larger and more monetized than the military industrial complex. And the military is the largest item in the budget. How do you get beyond all this? Congressman Pittenger.
Well, you know, Margaret Thatcher said, you win the argument before you win the vote. And we have some arguments to go win. And we had to look at what really has to be done in our country today and how do we address the fiscal issues. And, you know, the truth prevails. What's going to happen with the new healthcare program, it's going to evolve out. And we're going to see whether people can really keep their coverage. We're going to see whether the cost really does go up. We're going to see whether there really is a risk pool available for people. And over the next year or so, that's going to manifest. And I think then the people are going to be able to reassess, do we like this, we embrace it, or do we want to go fix it and change it?
So many of these issues are so complicated. Mm-hmm. It's difficult for Congress people who have to read reams of detailed information about this to understand. It's almost impossible for the public to understand. A lot of this, it would seem to me, is education. And we're not getting a lot of education in the mainstream media. We're just not. We're getting a lot of heat and talking points, but we're not getting a lot of real detailed information. And maybe that's something that the ordinary person can't digest, because the other day on one of the network newscasts, they asked people what should be done to get control of spending in Washington. And they asked, what would you cut? Would you cut Social Security? No. Would you cut Medicare? No. Would you cut veterans benefits? No. Would you cut defense spending? Absolutely not. Would you cut regulatory bodies like the FDA, who keeps track of pharmacies and foods and things like that? No. Would you cut money for air traffic control, which keeps planes? No. Well, then what are you going to cut? And spending is what you want to cut. So part of this has to be educating people on what we're spending money on and how we're spending it, right?
Certainly.
I would definitely agree with that it's educating the public on what's really happening. And, you know, one of the first things we decided to do in our caucus, we have these five task forces, but the specific focus right now is going after waste, fraud, abuse, and duplication. The GAO, the Government Accountability Office, puts out a report every year with billions of dollars of waste, fraud, abuse, and duplication. So we've decided to take that report, and within United Solutions, we are going to go through and pick out as much as feasibly possible to address and try to create some legislation to tackle this immediately and ensure that it doesn't keep happening every year. A lot of these GAO reports, a lot of the waste happens every year. We want to put it to an end. So that's some of the first legislation we're going to do, and we think that's something that we can, you know, solve in a bipartisan manner that doesn't, you know, take a whole lot of education.
If you were able to be successful on this move and eliminate much of, if not all of, the waste that you see and the fraud that exists out there, how much money are we talking about? I mean, would it be a significant amount of money that would help us toward our debt problems, or is it a drop in the bucket? Like foreign aid, people say, let's eliminate foreign aid. That's a drop in the bucket. It's not even it's almost negligible.
Let me give you some examples. The federal government owns over 50,000 buildings that are not used in properties. Mm-hmm. We spend over $8 billion a year just maintaining those properties. We have food stamps that are given out to people that are improperly given out. That's over $4 billion. There's real cost savings out there that need to be managed. And I think as we assess all these, it's like the Grace Commission that was done back in the early 80s. And that's really what I have proposed in terms of restructure of our government.
Was the Grace Commission successful? Was that an initiative of the Reagan administration?
Yes, it exactly was.
And he had an industrialist whose last name was Grace.
W.R. Grace.
Why the Grace Commission is called that. Mm-hmm. And they made recommendations to streamline and make changes in the government. Did they enact those? Was it successful? Have we backed away from those? What happened
there? Some of it was successful and some of it wasn't. I mean, there were recommendations made. They wanted some elimination of some departments. That didn't happen. They wanted some consolidations. Some of that did happen. It was marginally successful.
Because we keep having these commissions of people. Yeah. Frank I can't think of the Erskine Bowles, the
sure.
Simpson Bowles made some recommendations about monetary policy and debt, and that was completely ignored. And it was a Democratic selected committee, and the president ignored it.
Well, that's why we're doing ours is going to be in the form of legislation. I mean, we've considered commissions lie on the table and they go nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
We want to do real legislation. We're going to put it before the Congress.
Okay. Let me take a call here from somebody who's been holding on for quite a while.
The table and they go nowhere.
John, welcome to the program. John, are you there? Welcome to the program.
Before the Congress. Okay.
John, turn down your radio, please. Turn it off. Turn it down. John, go ahead.
Yes, I was glad to hear the congressman say that one of the first things that needs to be done with Social Security is to increase the current cap. And I would just suggest that why 150, why not 200,000, since the people who collect the largest Social Security amounts, including myself, are the ones who have the ability to pay more. Secondly, are they counting Social Security as a part of the debt, since, as I understand it, the Social Security Trust Fund, which is sort of a fiction that Congress agrees that the money's come in and that they pay a very low interest rate on, is what actually funds Social Security. It is funded by the people who are paying the payroll tax, which has now gone back up to 6.2%, which means that the fund will last longer.
Go ahead. Thank you for that question, John. You know, when I say the cap, I don't know, Robert might be getting nervous there. Everything, we're trying to put everything on the table and want these task force to come back with a balanced approach. We all know if we only do the cap that, you know, may not get agreed to. But that's certainly something we're looking at. I mean, some people have proposed legislation, we bring the cap to $500,000 or eliminate it entirely. So if you were to do that, it would solve the Social Security problem immediately. Right now, Social Security, the last numbers I saw had it had it sustainable of paying 100% of its benefits for the next 22 years. So it is not an immediate threat. Basically, what you have is with the baby boomers retiring, there is it's almost like a bell curve. You have a certain amount of time there where the baby boomers are retiring at a quick pace, and that's the period we need to account for. Right now, it is not adding to the deficit.
But the sooner
really
we do it,
that needs to be addressed is Medicare, and we started to touch on that and going through the waste, the fraud, that sort of thing. And that's really the 800-pound gorilla in the room is the health care costs in our country that are rising at almost an exponential rate, and we've got to get those under control.
But we spent four years trying to get this under control, and we've come up with a plan that nobody likes or very few people like, and there's a lot of mystery about exactly what will happen with it, and we never tackled that part of the issue. Why are you confident, or are you confident, that Congress can now turn around and re-tackle that issue? Because we just spent 4 years doing it.
Mike, one last thing.
Go ahead, John.
I'm so glad to hear the congressman point out that Social Security is not adding to the debt, because that is a fact when you're talking about the public not understanding what is happening with the various proposals. Is that, as the congressman has said, this program would be funded for the next 22 years as it is currently funded, and if the cap is increased, that will, let's say, to $200,000, that would probably take it out to 30 or 35 years when all of us baby boomers will be dead.
All right, thank you for your call. I appreciate it. Let me bring in a couple of emails here quickly before we run out of time. Gordon writes, I'm a fan of the group NoLabels.org that promotes compromise. Their core principles, such as no pay without a budget, would put us on the right path. It seems our two-party system can always agree on one thing. Unfortunately, that is regressing or repressing the formation of an alternative party that would increase accountability and expose the cycle of money and influence that benefits a wealthy donor base. You want to comment on that? Just move on.
Okay. It's a free country, and people.
I'm a proud member of No Labels. I've been trying to recruit Robert into it, and No Labels is a great group. It, you know, there's senators, there's members of the House, senior members, and it's a real good opportunity to put solutions on the table and hear from some of the more senior members that have been around and understand the legislation, what is doable.
I support No Labels. It's a matter of just find time to get over where I've got to be.
Okay. One of your core principles is tax reform. And I'm not sure what that means. I know we fought two wars off budget for 10 years and lowered taxes at the same time. And to me, that seems counterintuitive, like it can't be done.
Well, not totally. I think you saw $700 billion of new revenue come in the federal treasury as a result of those tax cuts. If we hadn't had it, we wouldn't have had that additional revenue.
Mm-hmm.
Sadly, we spent about $6 trillion in some wars.
Right.
So, I mean, that it costs that kind of money. You can question the merit of the wars, but
well, no, I'm not. That didn't even yeah. come into the question.
No,
the question
I,
is, how can you fight two wars that cost that money and not at least maintain taxes as the way they were, as opposed to cut them?
Well,
how can you do it?
Well, wait a minute.
I have to pay for it somehow, somewhere, someday.
That's an economic issue. I mean, John Kennedy cut taxes. Ronald Reagan cut taxes. You know, the tax cuts can stimulate an economy that creates more revenue. And I think
I don't disagree. But how can you fight wars that cost trillions of dollars and go on for 10 years?
Perhaps
and not,
if there were not the tax cuts, maybe there wouldn't have been the additional revenue. I mean, you have to buy into that as well.
How would you assess your progress to date with this? I know you're just getting started. You're a month into this Solutions Coalition. How would you assess your progress to date?
I think the fact that we have, you know, probably 40 of us involved right now, about half of our freshman class already, and we're just getting started, I'm very encouraged by that. And I think we have got working with Congressman Murphy, I think we have a great opportunity ahead of us.
You feel the same way, Congressman, in about 10 seconds or less?
I do. You know, you consider the previous Congress, they went years without anything like this. So we're a couple months into it, working hard, and have big goals.
Patrick Murphy, Florida's 18th District Congressman in Florida. He's a Democrat. Robert Pittenger, a Republican from North Carolina's 9th District, co-founders of the United Solutions Caucus in the House of Representatives. Thank you both for the hour. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of